Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LPFM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, July 16, 2005. Our focus today is on media issues. In our first hour, we'll hear from Joshua Myrowitz, UNH Communication Professor, author, and media analyst, who will talk about the Downing Street memos and mainstream media's poor coverage of the Iraq War. We'll also hear Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy, focusing this week on Kenneth Tomlinson's continuing attack on National Public Radio as liberally biased. We will then feature audio from last weekend's New Hampshire Peace Action Meeting, a talk on peace and sustainability given by Bert Cohen of UNH, and a visit from True Majority's Oreo-mobile. You'll have to stay tuned to get the story on that one. We'll end with Between the Lines out of Connecticut. We'll also have music, people's history, and more. We regret that we will not have the hoped-for interview with George Corrett from the Campaign to Get Democracy Now! Onto New Hampshire Public Radio this week. We hope to bring that to you in the near future. First, for some news. Here we have some excerpts taken from world news that we found particularly interesting and thought you might too. The first is from Foster's Daily Democrat here in New Hampshire. Hearing on water bottling plant turns ugly. The four-year fight over water saw tempers boil over and a police presence as one audience member, a USA Springs supporter, hollered a profanity in a brief verbal confrontation with one of the many in the crowd opposed to USA Springs' bid to withdraw more than 300,000 gallons of water per day from company wells off Route 4. Meanwhile, a lawyer for USA Springs said the protesters' repeated attempts to derail the local regulatory process is frustrating and a waste of resources. The heated objections started after the crowd grew frustrated with the board's attention to site review details. A woman in the audience asked if the board had the power to deny the application, and a board member replied, "Yes." The woman responded, "Then do it, then do it," as the audience cheered. Nottingham resident Elizabeth Smith and others asked the board to stand up for the public before it's too late. "What happens when our wells go dry?" she asked. Resident Diane Kirkwood urged the board to set a precedent since they are there to represent the interests of townspeople, 99% of whom she claims oppose the water project. "Set a precedent that the town and the citizens of the United States have a right to say no," she said. Save Our Groundwater member Bill McCann of Dover said that the planning board has the authority to deny the application based on water quality issues. McCann was a member of the legislature when it passed the state's large groundwater withdrawal permitting law. USA Springs lawyer Tony Saltani said in an interview that he disagrees that the board has purview over water quality. Saltani said he was frustrated that experts were not allowed a chance to testify Wednesday because of the oft-repeated objections from audience members. Earlier in Wednesday's meeting, resident Bill Garnett read a letter from Saltani's partner, Edward Mosca. The letter refers to Save Our Groundwater as a left-wing anti-capitalism organization. The planning board will continue its review at an August 10th workshop session. USA Springs wants to build a 176,000-square-foot water bottling plant off Route 4, where it proposes three lines, each to fill 600 half-liter bottles per minute. The final communique from the summit of G8 nations in the UK is a, quote, "disaster for the world's poor," end quote, says a statement from the World Development Movement issued on July 8th. The agreements on trade, debt, aid, and climate change are nowhere near sufficient to tackle the global poverty and environmental crisis we face, said Peter Hardstaff of World Development Movement. The deals on debt and aid fall way short of what is needed to achieve global poverty reduction targets, and on trade it's business as usual as the G8 attempt to bulldoze more liberalization out of the poor. These tiny sums of money are nothing more than a sticking plaster over the deep wounds the G8 are inflicting by forcing failed economic policies such as privatization, free trade, and corporate deregulation on Africa. Hardstaff says that the G8 countries made no significant unilateral commitments to change their damaging trade policies, are offering aid for trade deals, giving poor countries some extra aid money if they privatize and deregulate their economies. From the New York Times, GOP asks conservative allies to cool rhetoric over the court. In a series of conference calls on Tuesday and over the last several days, Republican Senate aides encouraged conservative groups to avoid emphasizing the searing cultural issues that social conservatives see at the heart of the court fight, subjects like abortion, public support for religion, and same-sex marriage. Instead, these participants, who insisted on anonymity to avoid exclusion from future calls, said the aides emphasized themes that had been tested in polls, including a need for a fair and dignified confirmation process. Mr. Euland acknowledged that he and others had been working almost since the vacancy occurred last Friday with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's resignation to persuade conservative activists to steer clear of divisive language. "Every contact we have with these folks is stay on message, stay on purpose," Mr. Euland said. "The extremism of language, if there is to be any, should be demonstrably on the other side. The hysteria and foaming at the mouth ought to come from the left." The disagreement underscored the balancing act confronting Republican leaders seeking to rally passionate conservatives behind a nominee while casting the candidate as moderate and middle of the road. While the Republican leadership encouraged a united front, many conservatives argued that it would be a mistake to ignore discussing what they considered the stakes. Tom Minnery, director of public policy for Focus on the Family, an evangelical group and broadcaster based in Colorado Springs, blamed leftist advocates for the decibel level of judicial confirmation debates and said his group planned to continue to address mainly social and cultural issues to get our constituents to understand how important this battle is. Officials of several Christian conservative groups who did not want to be identified because of what they said was pressure by the White House said they were continuing to urge the president not to nominate Mr. Gonzalez. Tuesday evening, Focus on the Family transmitted an email message to supporters with the title, "Bush Defends Gonzalez. Some conservatives wonder if Attorney General is right for the Supreme Court." Barrier meant to ensure Jewish majority. From the Associated Press. Israel's separation barrier in Jerusalem is meant to ensure a Jewish majority in the city and not just serve as a buffer against bombers, an Israeli cabinet minister acknowledged Monday. The statement by Haim Ramon, the minister in charge of Jerusalem, confirmed Palestinian claims that demographics and not only security determined the barrier route. The plan would separate 55,000 Palestinians from the city both sides want as a capital, bringing to the fore an explosive disagreement over who controls the holy city and where its boundaries should be. The 40-mile Jerusalem segment is part of a complex of walls, trenches, fences, and electronic devices Israel is building along the entire West Bank, dipping into the territory in some places to enclose main settlement blocks. Palestinians see the project as a land grab, not a security measure. Palestinian Foreign Minister Nasser al-Kidwa called Monday for stepped-up street protests against the barrier, marking a year since the World Court in The Hague handed down a non-binding decision that deemed the barrier illegal and ordered it torn down. He said Palestinians should organize for a higher level of daily confrontations against the wall. Opponents and supporters demonstrate almost daily at West Bank sites, where its construction uproots orchards or cuts Palestinians off from their farmland or services. Israel began building the barrier more than 2 years ago at the height of a wave of Palestinian suicide bombings. But Ramon said demography was also a main factor for the barrier route in Jerusalem. Ziv Boam, Israel's deputy defense minister, denied the barrier route was dictated by demographic considerations. Rahman said it was a mistake to enclose more than a dozen Arab villages in the city limits drawn after the 1967 war, when Israel captured the Arab section of Jerusalem along with the West Bank and Gaza. No other nation recognized Israel's annexation, including the Old City, with key sites holy to Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Visiting European Union Foreign Policy Chief Javier Solana criticized the Jerusalem barrier. "We think that Israel has a right to defend itself, but we think that the fence, when it is done outside the territory of Israel, is not legally proper, and it creates also humanitarian problems," he said after meeting with Israeli Foreign Minister Silvan Shalom. In another development, Vice Premier Shimon Peres said Monday that Israel will seek $2.2 billion in additional U.S. aid for the summer's withdrawal from Gaza and four West Bank settlements. Israel is already the biggest recipient of U.S. aid, getting an annual $2.3 billion for economic and military purposes. Now for an interview with Joshua Meyerowitz, UNH Communication Professor, author, and media analyst.
You're listening to Making Waves, and I'm Adam Meyerowitz, and today I'll be interviewing Joshua Meyerowitz, a professor of communication at the University of New Hampshire and an expert on the media. We will be discussing the Downing Street Memo and analyzing the role of the mainstream news media. Professor Meyerowitz, we've been hearing a lot about the Downing Street Memo. What exactly is it?
Well, the Downing Street Memo is now really a series of memos that have been leaked to the media in Britain. Top secret documents from 2002, before the war in Iraq, which discuss meetings between the British and the Americans about the war. And what they reveal is that almost everything that the Bush administration said about the buildup to the war was not true. The memos show that the U.S. planned to go to war with Iraq no matter what, while the president was claiming war was the last resort. The memo show that the intelligence about weapons of mass destruction and the terrorist threat from Iraq were really being shaped to fit the plan to go to war, that Iraq was not a real threat, that there was a very weak case about the weapons and the links to terrorism, that the British officials were very worried about the war being illegal and that some excuse for it needed to be found, that there would be pressure on the U.S. to go to the U.N. to create a kind of fig leaf of legality, because the plan was to give Saddam Hussein some ultimatum that they thought he would turn down, and that would be used as an excuse for the war. Unfortunately, as it turned out, Saddam Hussein accepted the ultimatum and let the inspectors in, and the Bush administration decided to stop the inspections and go to war anyway, which these documents suggest was the plan all along. Also, the memos reveal that the U.S. was increasing its bombing of Iraq quietly without reporting it much in order to try to get Iraq to respond, and then that response would be used as evidence of Iraqi aggression and another justification for the war, something else that didn't really work. And finally, Britain was concerned that the Americans had this plan to overthrow the Iraqi government, which besides being illegal under international law, also had was not accompanied by a plan of what to do once the government was overthrown, and they were concerned about the chaos that would ensue after this so-called victory. And of course, this has been revealed to be a very legitimate concern. So in short, these memos are a devastating critique of the Bush administration's honesty and its wisdom regarding the invasion of Iraq.
Why would the mainstream media try to avoid a story like the Downing Street Memo?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we hear so much about the aggressive watchdog media in our country, and you'd think they would really jump at this. And yet they've been very slow to cover it and dismissive in some of the coverage. And some of the claims have been that, well, anybody who wasn't brain dead knew that this is what the administration was planning. And this is kind of interesting because I'm sure that the reporters and editors at the time probably thought that, but that was not what they were sharing with the American public. That's not what was in the news. In the news were all these claims about the weapons of mass destruction, about the threats of terrorism, about the claimed interest in a peaceful resolution. And even in what were later unprecedented apologies by the New York Times and the Washington Post for their horrendously poor pre-war coverage, they said things that don't match up with their current claims. The New York Times said that, well, you know, our reporting was really bad and we had all these false stories, but that was the best intelligence that was available to anybody at the time. And so that doesn't make any sense in terms of what they're saying, that there's no new information in this these memos that say the intelligence was being manufactured basically to fit the plan. The Washington Post said that it, in its apologies, that it kind of crowded out stories that were raising questions about the claims of weapons because they were just so focused at the Washington Post in trying to figure out what the American administration was planning, which of course is ludicrous because you could see what they were planning from another planet. It's an interesting mix of things. So their arguments, I think, don't make very much sense. My argument for why there hasn't been a lot of coverage of it is that the media have been complicit in these deceptions. It's not just revealing the wrongdoing of the government. It's, in effect, revealing the wrongdoing of the media. If the mainstream media in this country gave huge coverage to the lies of Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Powell, Condoleezza Rice, and so forth, they'd in effect be saying, hey, you know, we go to liars to bring you the news. So they would be critiquing their own credibility. And additionally, if they did this, they would clearly be leading the public to say, well, why did you do it this way? Why do you keep going back to these liars? That would mean that the press would have to go to different people, do more research, hire more reporters, do more investigation, be less dependent on handouts from the government. All that would mean more money. It would mean stories that might upstage the ads. It would mean less profit. It would mean loss of stock value. The fact is that most of our news media don't have very many reporters to cover the world. Even the New York Times, which has one of the largest staffs in the mainstream media, has about 1,000 people. 900 of them work in New York City. About 65 cover the rest of the country, mostly from Washington. And then only 35 to 40 people cover the whole rest of the planet. How would you do that without relying on these handouts from officials? And many other newspapers, let's say USA Today, has only 4 people who cover the world outside the United States. So these are all problems for the mainstream media in terms of reporting on these memos. They're basically saying that the people we go to lie to us. And I think there's one additional problem, and that is, although the news claims to sort of tell us something different every day about what just happened, there are also sort of consistent stories in the news about the United States and the world. And one of the consistent stories is that the United States is a peace-loving country, that it never commits any aggression, that it responds to other people's aggressions hesitatingly and with care and not hurting innocent people. And these memos indicate a kind of level of cynicism about the leaders of our country and plans for aggressive war that just don't fit that story. And I think the mainstream media are very uncomfortable changing the narrative about the United States and the world.
What are some of the other big issues today that the mainstream media are avoiding?
Well, the mainstream media are pretty good at covering breaking events, something that fits into a 24-hour period. The jury came in with this verdict in a trial, a dam broke, and there was a flood that killed this many people, and so forth. The mainstream media in general are much worse at covering what Michael Schutzen has called oozing occurrences, that is, things that happen all the time and trends. So actually, many of the most important things that are happening in our country that don't fit into that 24-hour news period are not very well covered by our news media. The fact that we have the largest gap between rich and poor in this country of any industrialized country, and that it's growing, that our infant mortality rate is alarmingly high, that students do very poorly on standardized tests compared to most other industrialized countries, that we have a much less fair healthcare system than most industrialized countries, that we have the highest incarceration rate of any country, that the murder rate is very high, that there's environmental degradation, that's pollution, that fish stocks are disappearing, that the fish that we do catch are polluted with mercury and other problems, that many of our new technologies, which we're so excited about, cell phones and laptops, are actually hazardous wastes, and what happens to the waste stream as a result of those, and so forth. So the news media are very bad at covering stories that look at the larger time frame and that would tell us where we're heading, what are we going to do when we run out of oil, or that ask very critical questions about our country relative to other countries, or about the basic assumptions we make in this country that we have the best form of democracy, that we have the best economic system, and so they don't even cover in great detail all the irregularities that came up in the voting processes. They don't look at sort of systemic problems that grow out of the economic system and so forth. So in general, the media don't really do a very good job of telling us about the nature of our country and as the ways in which it compares and contrasts with other possible systems of living that exist in other countries.
What about the situation in Iraq? Do you think the TV, news, and other mainstream media outlets are giving a clear picture of what's happening there?
No, I think it's actually pretty bad coverage of the war, as you might guess. And mostly, I think one of the greatest concerns is that the news media don't really give any history, they don't give any context, so that we don't know anything about what the average Iraqi knows about the British, U.S., and French involvement in that area. During World War I, for example, the British and the French conspired to violate their promises to the Arabs to get independence, and they had a secret pact, the Sykes-Picot pact, to secretly divide the region among themselves. And the British got what we now call Iraq in 1917. They came in and said, you know, we're your liberators, we're not here to oppress you. The Iraqis, however, didn't really want to be liberated by the British. They wanted to be left alone. They revolted in 1920. The British bombed the hell out of them, gleefully destroying, according to some of the reports, whole cities. And then in 1921, they created the modern boundaries of Iraq, purposely cutting off Kuwait to prevent Iraq from having much access to the Gulf. And to put an Iraqi face on the government, they took a guy who the French kicked out of Syria, Faisal, and made him king of Iraq. And in the 1950s, when that government was overthrown by a popular leader, General Qasem, who wanted to then keep Iraqi oil for Iraqis' benefit, and he started OPEC and other things, the U.S. and the British worked to overthrow that popular leader. And in the 1960s, they supported a coup that killed Qasem, that helped the Ba'ath Party come to power, eventually led to Saddam Hussein's rise to power. And so there's a whole history there that the Iraqis know, including that in the late 1970s, U.S. helped, or the U.S. encouraged Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. They gave him satellite intelligence, they gave him AWACS intelligence, and helped him guide the application of chemical weapons against the waves of suicide attackers from Iran. And then even at the near the time of the first Gulf War, the U.S. was still shipping weapons and supplies to Saddam Hussein with the help of George Bush Sr., helped build up him as an ally. And even when the Iraqi troops were massing on the Kuwaiti border, the U.S. ambassador, April Glaspie, told Saddam Hussein that the U.S. had no opinion about this border dispute with Kuwait, and that she understood the economic issues involved, because among other things, the Kuwaitis had been moving the border during the Iran-Iraq war and using slant drilling equipment to pump out Iraqi oil and sell it on the market below the price that Saddam Hussein could pay back his war debts for the Iran-Iraq war. So she expressed support for this and basically said, this is an Arab-Arab affair, and basically do whatever you want. This was understood by Saddam Hussein to be an invitation to invade Kuwait. So there's a whole history here that tends not to get reported, and the U.S. media went along with reporting all kinds of fake atrocity stories and other stories to encourage the first Gulf War. And even in the current war, there are very significant emphases and omissions that support one story over another. For example, lots and lots of coverage of the April 9th, 2003 toppling of the Saddam Hussein statue in Fearless Square. Maybe 100 Iraqis were there at the in the square opposite the hotel where all the journalists were situated. How exactly they got there in the middle of a battle, who they were, was never reported. The 200 times as many people who were protesting just a few days later, telling the U.S. to get out of the country, got a lot less coverage. And that's been the general pattern. We hear all kinds of things about rebuilding Iraq and women, girls can go to school now in Iraq. The fact is, women were always able to go to school in Iraq. And if anything, what stopped them were the years of sanctions between the two wars, sanctions led by the U.S. that took this very prosperous country and reduced it to near starvation levels. The U.S. purposely destroyed the civilian water supply in Iraq, according to documents that are on the Pentagon's website. The sanctions led to near starvation diet among 23 million people, a million of whom are estimated to have died. The depleted uranium used in the first Gulf War is believed to have caused a huge spike in cancer deaths. So just a few examples of things that the mainstream media almost never mention about the history, the context of the U.S. wars with Iraq, things that would explain much better than the stories we have heard why Iraqis overall have not greeted the U.S. with flowers and ribbons and applauded their arrival. So I guess in general I'd say the media's coverage of the wars in Iraq has been atrocious.
Do you feel that these trends in the media have started recently or have been happening for a while?
Well, you know, I think as Dickens said, it's the best of times and the worst of times. I think in some ways there's continuity. Things are somewhat similar to the way they've been in the past. In some ways, things are much worse than they've been in the past, and in other ways, things are much better. In terms of continuity, the mainstream news media in our country, and it's true in other countries as well, has tended to be very dependent on official stories, which are often not true, so that there were lies about what happened in Iran in 1953. We were told there was a spontaneous revolt, and the people overthrew their communist dictator. Actually, the U.S., the CIA, with the help of H. Norman Schwarzkopf Sr., overthrew a democratic secular government in Iran because he wanted to nationalize the British petroleum company. And the CIA set up a dictator, the Shah, and trained his secret police, Savak, and helped to keep him in power for 26 years. And we didn't hear very much about that. We still don't hear very much about it, though we hear about the great threat that Iran is to us. The next year, 1954, we heard about the Guatemalans spontaneously rising up and overthrowing their communist dictator. Actually, this was the U.S. invading Guatemala, essentially, and protecting United Fruit land that the elected democratic non-communist leader of Guatemala wanted to buy some of the reserved land to distribute it to peasants and do some land reform in a country that was basically run by a U.S. corporation. And on and on, the same types of distortions about Vietnam, about Chile, Brazil, Panama, the first Gulf War. So there's been some continuity. What might be new about this administration is that this period is that the administration is lying so persistently and so outrageously that the same continuing procedures of the news media of reporting what the government says, objectively reporting the lies, these things are true in a very narrow technical sense. The government really did say this, but what they said may not be true. There may be an upping of the distortion in that sense. But otherwise, it's kind of a pattern that's existed before. What is worse is that we have had deregulation of the media, which means that they are no longer required in the broadcast media to serve the public interest. There are fewer companies that have been allowed to gobble up more and more of the media. The reporters have been fired. News bureaus have been closed. There's less investigative reporting. There's more concern for maximizing profits. There's a blending of news and entertainment and a lot of coverage of celebrity trials and the like. There's more reliance on officials and public relations, including video news releases that stations often run without saying that they were just handouts from public relations firms or from the government. And there's more, so we have more homogeneity of stories. And as these media lobby, these media corporations lobby the government to control even more of the media, they're very hesitant to be very critical of the government. So those are some of the things that are getting worse. In terms of what's getting better, I think that there are some promising trends. I think larger proportions of the public are more questioning of the media. You saw unprecedented levels of protest before this war even started. That's never happened before, to have millions of people around the world protest a war that has not yet started. And that was organized with the help of the internet and alternative media. You have much more pressure on the mainstream media now, including with regard to covering the Downing Street memos, because of people's access to the memos online and because of anywhere there's a story published in any medium in the world, it's recycled online. And I think that many reporters are eager to get this information out, and they now know that if they write even a little story in the back that's placed in the back pages of a paper, that truthout.org or another alternative online site will send it around to tens of thousands of people. Also, the low cost of camcorders and new electronics is leading to the development of independent media. And you also have now unprecedented apologies expressed by the media about poor coverage. Newspapers that hesitated for a long time to have ombudsmen like the New York Times have recently relented and now have them. So I think that there's a mix. There are some things that are the same as they've been. There are some things that are much worse, and there are some very promising trends that are in play.
What would you suggest people do to try to see through all the myths, lies, and half-truths in the mainstream media?
Well, a lot of it depends on simply paying attention and thinking critically and paying attention to the news kind of defensively and actively. There's actually an enormous amount of information in the mainstream media if you know how to read the news and know how stories are timed through the week. Often the most interesting stories are in Saturday's newspaper because they're released on a Friday afternoon with the hope that they'll get into Saturday's paper, or maybe not even, because the paper is, Saturday's paper is often pretty much filled because a lot of journalists don't like to work on the weekends and they've written the stories ahead of time. And so this kind of, if anything, it's these stories may be squeezed in there, and they're purposely released on a Friday because even if they get into Saturday's paper, people know that Saturday's paper has fewer readers. There are no offices and officials around to comment on it. By Monday, it's kind of old news. So if you know how to read the timing of the news, you know how to read signals about the government is very worried about this or that, you know that maybe some plan is afoot. You also can see a lot of small stories in the back pages that give a lot of information that's not in the headlines on the front page. And in fact, with the help of truthout.org, which is I highly recommend, which sends around these little stories, those who paid attention to truthout.org before the war knew that every major claim about weapons and terrorist links had been pretty much disproved, and that was before the war. I would suggest paying attention to the mainstream media and to the alternative media that circulate interesting stories from the mainstream media. Also paying attention to the alternative media themselves, there with indiemedia.org, The Nation, The Progressive in these times, which have a much better track record, a truth track record than the mainstream media. And in general, I would suggest using the logic of eBay and these online sites where you rate the seller. I would encourage people to rate the sellers of information and to be suspicious when the news media keep going back to the people who had it all wrong before, or who perhaps were deceptive before. Also, I think it does help to write to news organizations. It's very easy now with email, and to show that you may know more about something than they're reporting. They often make it seem that they're the experts and the public doesn't really understand, but I think they do react to getting these messages, especially when you write it in your own words without being abusive and so forth. And as we've always heard, contact your representatives, go to meetings when a senator or congressman has a local meeting, express your concerns. It may sometimes feel like you're talking to a wall, but I think in the long run these things have an impact. And also I think the public in general needs to keep an open mind about alternative narratives about the United States and the world. And I also think we need to be wary of the we that we often hear. We need to think critically about the we. We use the we in this country to include the president, our military, corporations. We think, you know, what's good for us, any of us, is good for all of us, when actually a war may be good for this corporation and that corporation and for certain interests in the United States, but not for others. It may be very bad for others. And I think we need to be critical of the use of the word we. I think we should avoid, and I have trouble doing it as well, saying things like, you know, we invaded Iraq, or we overthrew the government of Guatemala. I mean, I didn't do it, and you didn't do it. And yet, when you use the we, it's very hard then to critique the policy because you think, well, we're good. And I think we need to use the they more often than we tend to do. Also, I think we should lobby to get programs like Democracy Now! And Making Waves on public radio stations and on more stations. And of course, we should support low power stations like WSCA.
Thank you very much, Professor Meyerowitz, for your observations.
It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Making Waves. This is Adam Meyerowitz.
The CIA is pushing crack in the ghettos of LA, while the food crops in Colombia get sprayed by the DEA. The FBI is reading your email with something called the carnivore, while the rich are getting richer and the poor are staying poor. They're launching nuclear-powered ships up into space. One little accident could wipe out half the human race. They're putting radioactive waste into your silverware, or maybe your toaster, or perhaps your wheelchair. The Air Force is bombing Iraq every other day. They don't like the government, so the children have to pay. And the ozone hole is growing, the sheep are going blind, while the U.S. spends more on arms than the rest of the world combined. Journalists are getting fired from San Jose to Atlanta when they write about reality, not a fluff piece for Fanta. A death threat every week, and sometimes life is short when the truth is too dangerous for someone to report. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? The cancer rates are skyrocketing, though people are smoking less. If you live near a nuke, your life is bound to be a mess. Clean water's almost gone all over the earth, and what's left they want to privatize and see how much it's worth. Chevron is gunning down the students of Nigeria, turning the land to waste while the babies die of diphtheria. And the temperatures are rising, the world's forests are on fire. Pretty soon Brazil will be one raging funeral pyre. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? One in three adult Americans cannot read or write, and their children go to bed hungry every night. 2 million U.S. citizens are rotting behind bars, and while they're there, they're working hard building parts for cars. The Army's running torture schools to keep the earth under control, and they're relocating Navajos so they can mine some extra coal. Our taxes pay McDonald's to sell tumors in Shanghai, while 100,000 poison vets are just about to die. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? And the people are resisting wherever you may go. And this is the single biggest fact they don't want you to know. From New Delhi to New Mexico, there are battles going on. And the darkest hour is just before the dawn. In Berkeley and New York, they're raiding radio stations, trying to turn the voice of the people into the voice of the corporations. Will we seize the airwaves, wipe the sweat off of our brow? Stand and face the beast and shout democracy now. Who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? That we're living in these times? That we're living in these times.
That was David Rovics with Who Will Tell the People. Now for Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. This episode features a grilling on Capitol Hill as Corporation for Public Broadcasting Chairman Kenneth Tomlinson faces a bipartisan third degree at a Senate hearing. But when these fireworks over public broadcasting end, will PBS and NPR be better or worse for wear? From Urbana, Illinois.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
It was a bona fide grilling on Capitol Hill as Corporation for Public Broadcasting Chairman Kenneth Tomlinson faced a bipartisan third degree at a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee hearing on July 11th. Tomlinson first faced criticism from Illinois Democrat Senator Dick Durbin about his crusade against the program Now and its host, Bill Moyers. Tomlinson spent tens of thousands of dollars on questionable contracts to monitor Now and other programs for signs of liberal bias. Not that the research these so-called monitoring reports produced was worth the paper they were scribbled on.
He was paid thousands of dollars. His data, riddled with spelling errors, was faxed to you from a Hallmark store in downtown Indianapolis.
It's like Bob Dylan said, you know, you don't need weather the vane to see which way the wind's blowing. It was very clear that the mortgage program was liberal advocacy journalism. I wanted a statistical basis because I didn't think people were responding appropriately.
Moyers would like to debate Tomlinson publicly about conservative complaints with public broadcasting. After some prodding by Senator Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania, Tomlinson agrees to one in principle, but would rather not have to.
Now, this thing between Mr. Moyers and me could be a lot of fun. We would have a lot of fun debating on television for an hour about that. It would not be good for public television, and I think Mr. Moyers and I both agreed that in recent weeks we didn't think it was in the interest of public broadcasting for us to continue.
You think it would be a lot of fun?
It would be a lot of fun.
Well, would you think it ought to be broadcast on Saturday Night Live?
That's probably where it belongs.
Alaska Republican Ted Stevens thinks Tomlinson's bias crusade has hurt NPR and PBS, leading in part to recently proposed cuts of more than $100 million to the federal CPB budget, cuts public broadcasting cannot afford.
Members said that Congress ought to calm down. This system needs our support. I deplore the fact that there's some people within it that want to exercise their political bias in delivering it. I think the board's problem is to get rid of that and restore the balance that existed in the past in the system.
The full Senate's expected to vote on the spending bill containing the public broadcasting provisions later this summer. In the interim, the Inspector General at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has opened an investigation into how CPB's new president, Patricia Harrison, was hired for the job. CPB Chair Tomlinson streamlined the hiring process so as to position Harrison as the top candidate. Harrison has a long history as a State Department propagandist and is a former chair of the Republican National Committee. This joins an ongoing probe into Tomlinson's misguided bias and balance crusade.
Eventually, this round of political fireworks over public broadcasting will end. Where will PBS and NPR be then? Better or worse for wear? There will still be funding shortfalls and partisan pressure, which over the last 10 years has especially taken its toll on public television, according to Jerry Starr, executive director of Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting.
Public television in England and France and Germany and Italy, the Netherlands, Norway, Sweden and Spain attract audience shares of between 33% and 49%, with Denmark at 69%. PBS claims 3%.
Dr. Ernest Wilson agrees that something drastic must be done. But Wilson, who's been a member of the CPB Board of Directors since 2000, says the problem is one of demographics.
You know, we really have those eyeballs between 1 year old and 7 years old, and then we lose them for the next 40 years. And so we have, you know, the 47 on crew. We have got to find a way to get more audiences between the ages of 8 and 46. And that's probably going to involve, that's certainly going to involve some reforms to the current system of deciding what goes on the air and making it more responsive to diverse perspectives.
One thing you won't hear out of Washington is the notion of fundamental reform to the public broadcasting system. While proposals exist to create an independent trust fund for public broadcasting purposes, Wilson says they have no momentum to speak of.
You cannot expect the Congress on its own. You cannot expect the boards of these organizations to be really in the forefront and think outside the box. It's got to come from the grassroots.
To that end, several groups, including Free Press, are planning a series of nationwide public meetings in hopes of engaging local public radio and TV stations in dialogue about bottom-up reform.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
And now for some people's history. July 16th in 1862, Ida B. Wells, journalist, activist, and anti-lynching organizer, was born. Here's some more information about her. Ida Bell Wells Barnett was born in 1862. She was an African-American journalist, advocate of civil rights, women's rights, economic rights, and an anti-lynching crusader. Ida B. Wells Barnett, the first of eight children, was born 6 months before the enactment of the Emancipation Proclamation. She attended what was then Shaw University, now Rust College, in her hometown of Holly Springs, Mississippi, until she was forced to drop out when her parents died of yellow fever in 1878. Following their deaths, Wells Barnett supported herself and her siblings by working as a schoolteacher in rural Mississippi and Tennessee. She took summer courses at Fisk University and continued to teach through 1891, when she was fired for writing an editorial that accused the Memphis School Board of providing inadequate resources to segregated black schools. In May 1884, Wells Barnett sued a railroad company after she was forced off a train for refusing to sit in the Jim Crow car designated for blacks. Wells Barnett embarked on a career in journalism when she was elected editor of the Evening Star and then the Living Way, weekly church newspapers in Memphis. Her articles, written under the alias Iola, were direct and confrontational. Two editorials she wrote in 1892 in response to the persecution and eventual lynching of three black businessmen were particularly controversial. The first encouraged blacks to leave Memphis for Oklahoma and to boycott segregated transportation. The second suggested that white women were often the willing initiators in interracial relationships. In 1895, she published an analysis of lynching entitled A Red Record. She helped to found the National Association of Colored Women in 1896, the Negro Fellowship League, and the NAACP in 1909. During the last 15 years of her life, Wells Barnett wrote extensively on the race riots in East St. Louis, 1917, Chicago, 1919, and Arkansas, 1922. She continued to promote civil rights and justice for African Americans. That information, was from the African American Registry, which you can check out at www.aaregistry.com. Last Sunday, July 10th, New Hampshire Peace Action held its annual meeting. One of the highlights of the day was a visit by True Majority's Oreomobile. The Oreomobile uses giant Oreos to illustrate our budget priorities in this country. Stanley Longstaff recorded some of the presentation on a windy day, you'll notice, and then took a few minutes to talk with the driver and presenter of the Oreomobile, Aaron Rubin.
Education K through 12, free Oreos. World hunger, poverty, and AIDS, one Oreo, $10 billion. Children's health care, four Oreos. Energy independence, the programs that are designed to wean us off of our reliance on Mideast oil, that would be a quarter of an Oreo. Job training, one Oreo, and deficit reduction, well, that would be zero. So we presented this information to a cross-section of Americans in our poll, and this is what they told us. Democrats, Republicans, independents, liberals, conservatives, across the board, they said that not only would they not spend their money that way, but they would take a little bit of money off transportation and a whole lot of money off the Pentagon budget, an average of $125 billion. And spend it on things like education, world hunger, children's health care, and deficit reduction. So we've got a board of military advisors, retired generals, admirals, including Dr. Larry Korb, who was the former Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan, Admiral Stansfield Turner, who was head of the CIA, and this is what they told us. These are conservative guys, and they couldn't go for a $125 billion cut, as you could imagine. What they did say is that we could take $60 billion, six Oreos, off the Pentagon budget, because that was money for programs designed during the Cold War, intended for use against the Soviet Union, were obsolete weapon systems. So what I'm going to do is we're going to have some fun with Oreos, and we're going to take those Oreos, and I'm going to show you what we can buy with them. If you hold on, I'm going to go climb Mount Oreo over here. And I'm coming around. So can you see me up here? The air is kind of thin. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, six Oreos. That's one, two, three, four, five, six. Now here we come down. Okay, this is what the American people said they wanted to spend their money on. Your money, our money. Education K through 12, one Oreo, $10 billion would be enough over 10 years to rebuild and modernize every school in America and return to the state of New Hampshire more than $500 million over that 10-year period. Now, world hunger, let's put an Oreo here. Take another one, split in half. That's $15 billion in over 10 years. You know what that would do? There are 6 million children every year around the world that are dying of starvation, and this would take care of every one of them. So let's take another Oreo, and we'll put it on children's health care. That's $10 billion. That would provide health care coverage for every one of the 9 million children in the United States who aren't already insured. Let's take another Oreo, put it on energy independence, and over a period of 10 years, that would provide enough money for programs for energy efficiency and conservation and renewable energy to reduce our use of oil by 50%. Let's take half an Oreo, put it on job training. You know, there are 250,000 Americans who are laid off every year because of trade agreements like NAFTA. This would provide training for 250,000 Americans every year. And let's take that last Oreo and do something we haven't done in a while. Pay down the national debt. So people are going to say, well, you know, that's all well and good. You've got this guy, you know, with a bunch of giant Oreos, and he's moving them from one pile to the next. And, you know, so what does that prove? Although you have to admit it's kind of a unique talent. But what is that going to do to our security around the world? And the reality is the largest expenditure of military funds by a country that is potentially an adversary, and that's Russia. And this is what they spent. Seven Oreos. that's $70 billion, and you know, they're pretty much an ally of ours nowadays. The next highest expenditure, China. $50 billion, five Oreos, and the last time I checked, they were a major trading partner. And what about those guys that we're all worried about, what's left of the Axis of Evil and rogue states? All together, they spend one Oreo, $10 billion. But people are going to say, well, what are you going to cut? Because we've got troops, you know, that are at risk. They're going to war. They have no body armor. Their families are getting food stamps. I mean, isn't this going to harm them? Our military advisor has told us that that $60 billion that we're taking from the Pentagon, that's for obsolete weapon systems designed during the Cold War, intended for use against the Soviet Union, no longer relevant in today's world. And let me give you just one example of what one of those weapon systems are. This demonstration I'm going to do down here involves some BBs and a garbage can. It's kind of an audio demonstration. All right, I'm going to drop some BBs in this can. Here's one BB. That's equivalent to 15 times the firepower of the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. And now let me tell you why I'm talking about that. It's because we spend $20 billion a year for a nuclear arsenal. Here's another six. That's enough to destroy Russia. Now, let me show you what it is our entire arsenal sounds like. And that's equivalent to 150,000 Hiroshima bombs. Now, you know, that's a lot of bombs, but we at ShowMeTheMoney.net look at it as an opportunity because our advisors tell us that we can cut that budget in half and still have enough bombs to kill everybody on Earth four times over, and they say that would be enough. But what it would also do is provide $10 billion in Oreo, which would go a long way towards providing the kinds of benefits that people have told us that they want. So what can we do? Well, there's legislation that's going to be introduced before Congress called the Common Sense Budget Act. And what that would do with the kinds of spending shifts we're talking about. Thanks again, and thank you for all you do.
What's your name?
Aaron Rubin.
And who are you with, Aaron?
I'm with ShowMeTheMoney.net, which is a project of Business Leaders for Sensible Priorities, which is an organization of business people like former heads or current heads of Goldman Sachs, Visa Card, Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream, Hasbro Toys. These are people that got together and said it just didn't make any sense that this country couldn't take care of its human needs at the same time being the wealthiest country on Earth. And they decided to look at the federal budget, and they were astonished. And we've done poll after poll after poll showing this information to the American people, and consistently across the board, Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives tell us that Pentagon is getting too much money, children's health care is getting a short shrift, and we need to change our budget priorities.
Now, I see you have your van here with the whole budget in a pie shape with a lot of little slivers and then one big one being the Pentagon. So you've been traveling around. Where have you been traveling?
Well, actually, we've just started out in New Hampshire. We've just begun this campaign. Now, Business Leaders for Sensible Priorities has been doing this campaign for years, but this is really our first weekend appearance with the ShowMeTheMoney.net Oreo Mobile. New Hampshire's a great place, and we intend to go from one end of it to the other and provide information to people because they make up their own minds. We don't have to push an agenda here. What happens is when people see the information and see how much the Pentagon is getting compared to everything else, and that so much of the Pentagon money is for obsolete weapon systems that were designed during the Cold War for use against the Soviet Union, and everybody knows the Soviet Union is no longer, that it really doesn't make any sense to Americans to spend so much money on the Pentagon when we could take just a little bit of it and rebuild all of our schools, feed millions of people around the world, provide health care for every child in America, and this would not encompass raising taxes or going further into debt.
Now, this is quite the visual with all the subjects of the job training and energy independence, children's health care, world hunger, education, etc., in the Pentagon and other countries' military budgets. Why do you think this is a good way to present it?
Well, we wanted to make it light. I mean, the budget has numbers that are so big that they're hard to imagine. It's such a complicated document that it's hard to read through. And we thought that we could really cut it down to basics and provide it in a way so that people could understand what was going on. And we thought we'd use Oreo cookies because they're the perfect dessert to stack up and show what it is that we're spending our money on. And everybody knows Oreos, and everybody loves Oreos, and everybody stacks up Oreos, and everybody splits them in half and plays with them. So we thought we'd play with some extraordinarily large Oreos.
And then over here you have the baby with number of children not covered by health insurance. Canada, zero. Great Britain, zero. Italy, zero. Japan, zero. Germany, zero. USA, 9 million.
That's a 14-foot inflatable baby who's not real happy right now, because that baby represents the 9 million children in the United States who don't have health care coverage. And it would take less than 1.5 Oreos, less than $15 billion out of the $420 billion Pentagon budget to provide health care coverage for every single one of them.
Why do you think there are 9 million children uninsured in the U.S. and every other industrial nation in the world is covering their children?
My bet is that we spend a larger percentage of our budget on military than anyone else. And frankly, we've dropped the ball on this. People assume that it would cost a fortune to provide health insurance for all these children. And the fact of the matter is, not only would it not cost a fortune, but the money is already there. And every other country that's industrialized on Earth takes care of their kids. There's no reason why the United States can't do the same thing.
You mentioned also that the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan isn't even in this stack of Oreos here.
No, that's right. This $420 billion, the current proposed budget, does not include the $82 billion appropriation for Iraq this year. So if you add that on top of the $420 billion. Now you've got a stack of 50 cookies. And then if you add Homeland Security on top of that, that's another 30 or 40 billion, three or four cookies. And at that point, we wouldn't be able to drive this thing around because it would be way too tall.
And that's also just the money that was appropriated this year for Iraq. That doesn't even go back the last 2 years.
That's correct. I think the numbers that I've heard, we've spent about $200 billion on Iraq. Again, that's not included in the $420 billion Pentagon budget this year.
Well, thanks very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.